Hello and welcome to the Penny Lane Podcast in this very special 420 episode with Graham Farrar. This episode is brought to you by Pennies Going in Raw.
The stock market is hotter than ever right now, and traders are taking advantage. But what does that mean for the people who still haven't started trading? The market can be a little intimidating at first, but you don't have to be alone in the learning experience. We at the Pennies Going in Raw podcast are here to help you. I'm Dan, and with my co-host Hugh Henney, we make the stock market a fun but informative experience for our listeners. We offer knowledge for all levels of traders, from beginners to those who do it full time. On PGIR, we discuss up-to-date news about the stock market and interview other traders who all started out just like us and made it big. You'll hear from Hugh and other multi-millionaire traders, founders and CEOs of companies, FinTwit superstars, and even professional athletes. Have you ever thought about investing your hard-earned cash but don't know where to start? Do you have money just sitting in your savings account collecting dust? We were all there once too. Listen to Pennies Going in Raw on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Graham, hi, welcome to the Penny Lane Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. Happy to be here.
Thrilled to have you. Alice, I feel so lucky to get to hang out with you twice in one day.
Yeah, she texted me earlier. She's like, hey, you want to talk to the weed guy? And I'm like, fuck yeah.
The weed guy?
Yeah, I know you're way more than a weed guy.
I actually sent out a group text to the four people who co-host with me, and I was like, first come, first serve, who wants this interview? Snagged it. Yeah,
I even did my research too, so I'm definitely excited. It's a new industry, and seeing a good face of it, you guys are pretty reputable in the industry. I think it'd be cool, especially because there's definitely a lot of young guys that want to get involved in the industry, and you being a face and coming on and sharing your story, I think would benefit a lot of people.
Awesome. Well, happy to be here. It's a great industry, right? I mean, we're so early, and we're just making that transition from, you know, kind of in the shadows to out in the open. And I think it's a fantastic, especially for young people, opportunity, right? I mean, it's such a so much smaller of a pond that if you're a software developer or a marketer or a graphic designer, it's like, you know, you might be one of 1,000 good graphic designers in CPG. You can be one of 10 graphic designers in cannabis, right? And so like that opportunity to be an expert, to be good at what you do, but then become an expert in cannabis has put you in a much smaller, you know, the Venn diagram of that gives you a real leg up, I think. So if you're willing to make
absolutely
job, awesome opportunity.
How long have you been in the cannabis industry?
So I mean, it's kind of two sections, right? I've been in cannabis for probably 25 years back, you know, right at the beginning of legalization, even slightly before Prop 215, just because I loved cannabis and think that cannabis makes the world a better place. I think my first did it myself grow was probably 1996 in a 6-square-foot closet in Boulder, Colorado. So
this is my high school boyfriend. Same thing. Like it was in the basement. He ordered the grow lights. He was a single dad. The dad never came downstairs. So it was like a year and a half. We're like deeply invested in growing these plants. And then one day the dad came down and was done. Like killed all the plants, all for naught.
So I was in an apartment. It was a 2-bedroom apartment in Boulder. I took over my closet. I mean, and I went all out. I'm a tech geek. So like, you know, I had Mylar and remote controlled carbon filter fans and CO2 dosing and it was an ebb and flood system that I made with like 2 reservoirs and some bricks and a timer. So the irrigation was all automated. My roommate didn't know for like 9 months that I was growing in the closet. And then finally, like, he was like, God, it sounds like it's raining. It's not raining. And like, he was about to freak out and like thought we had a burst pipe turned on. It turned out it was just the irrigation. And he was like, oh, it's fine. Just, I want to have some to smoke. and the real positive impact was my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife. I'm pretty sure the first 5 months she only hung out with me because I had good weed and she was living in the dorms, so I could take her out to eat because I was growing my own versus eating cafeteria food. And I think she likes me now, but back then I think it might have been just the food.
Well, whatever it takes, you know.
So that's a love story.
This first, you've got the weed in the closet, and then you harvest the first batch. Mm-hmm. Would you say that was like a mind-blowing product, or was it something that you maybe needed to tweak?
I mean, it was pretty damn good, especially, you know, for the first run. And I'm talking like just a picture, 6 square feet, 3 feet by 2 feet. We got probably, I think, 6 rock wool blocks in there. There's literally like 6 plants in the whole thing. But good climate, great light for the space, CO2, the whole bit. So, and, you know, pretty good genetic clones I got from my friends. I think it was blueberry. I think it was the first strain I grew. And like it was, I'll say this, it was drastically better than what most of my friends had in their stash. So on the one hand, I got to smoke great weed. On the other hand, I had a whole bunch of customers out there when I had it. And like, you know, it disappeared, sold the whole thing. I mean, this is back, you know, I was hand trimming it and stuff like that. So it was pretty good. It does kind of blow my mind, though. I was thinking, we had just finished building our nursery here at our new farm. Our nursery, which has also had been flooded. So basically the same basic type of system, but it is almost 100,000 times bigger than that closet. It was, you know, 500,000 square feet here. And so just to think about like 25 years ago, maybe even 26 now, same thing, 100,000 times bigger is kind of a funny mind tweak or whatever.
All the college closets in America.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, to finish the rest of the story. So from that initial grow, again, like, you know, I've always been a believer that cannabis makes the world better. Certainly for me, you know, I don't get hungover. I feel healthier. I feel more relaxed, all that. And, you know, at the time there was a lot of DARE education and anti-drug war stuff. But one of the things that I think they really messed up with is instead of doing the more rational approach of saying, hey, like cannabis has good things, cannabis has okay things, and cannabis has risks. Kids shouldn't use it. Grownups can make their choices. Here's, you know, them things to be aware of. They said this, you know, good people don't use cannabis, right? And so this black and white thing, well, when you see that good people do use cannabis and when you experience it firsthand, then you're like, okay, the whole thing's full of shit. Why do I listen to it at all? And so I've got a, you know, kind of philosophy that the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice, to steal a quote from Martin Luther King. So if I'd figured that out, then my kind of assumption was everybody else was eventually going to figure that out. And so I dove in a little bit deeper with, you know, garages and houses and, you know, et cetera, you know, kind of up to small warehouse style stuff of growing indoor. Well, you know, I'm trying to do it compliant. I had my licenses from the doctor and stuff like that on the wall, but bigger scale. And then eventually realized like, hey, this is really going to happen. Saw the progress in California, started a company making fertilizer for cannabis growers on a larger scale. And then realized that we were teaching non-cannabis growers how to grow cannabis just so they could be our customer. And finally said, well, if we can do it better than them and they're the best farmers, but not for this crop, why don't we just do it ourselves? And that was really where Glasshouse Farm started 7 years ago or so.
Very cool. Very cool. So, just because I'm interested. So the first harvest, back to the first harvest.
Okay.
What? Yes. Yeah. What exactly was it about that harvest that made it so good? And I mean, was it like visually, or was it the way it smelled, or the texture, or actually like the high from it? Like what qualifies it as being sort of a step above something you could buy from somebody else?
Yeah. So going deep in the memory, the thing I remember the most about it was the smell. It was a blueberry strain, and it truly smelled like blueberries. And, you know, that was at a time when, you know, I won't call it brick weed, but it wasn't the highest quality, you know, weed that we were smoking most of the time. So when you, on the one hand, you're kind of used to, you know, I don't know what, call it the Coors Light, right? Or Jose Cuervo Gold. And then somebody walked in with the 1942, right? You're like, I didn't know tequila could be like this, right? And it was a little bit like that. I'm sure there was a little bit of just, it was, nobody thinks their own baby's ugly. There's probably a bit of that. And, you know, I did think I used to brew beer myself as well. And there's just something when you know the process and the connection to it that you appreciate it more. A couple of my friends, you know, had kind of watched the whole thing happen. So they were probably a little biased and predisposed to it. But really, it was the smell, I think. The smell and the color. It was bright green fluorescent, and it really smelled like blueberries in a time when most things smelled closer to lawn trimmings and looked closer to brown than green.
Very cool. How long between harvesting it and smoking it? Like, what's the drying period or the whatever has to happen.
I mean, in general, we like to do like kind of a 7 to 10 day dry. This is talking present tense now. We do a whole plant hang dry currently. It's kind of low and slow. It's a cool, dark place. Call it 62% humidity and 62 degrees Fahrenheit. That's kind of 7 to 10 days there. And then ideally you cure it for, you know, another couple to 2 to 3 weeks after that, before you smoke.
What is curing? Like if someone that doesn't like anything isn't in the industry, like what is curing?
Yeah. So, it's interesting because I am of the opinion that people spend a lot of time and focus and energy on the cultivation side, but that's really, you know, unlike vegetables, when you grow the tomato, you're done, you put it in a box, you ship it. Cannabis is a lot more like making wine. When you grow it, you're halfway done, right? And the other half is after you harvest it, the drying process and the curing process and the trimming process, you can't make something bad good, but you can certainly take something that's good and make it bad. And so one of the things that we're spending a lot of time on is really kind of building that formula and figuring out, you know, from the subjective to the objective of how do we make a really high quality, consistent post-harvest process. Curing is basically a cool, dark aging time where you're exchanging the air on some sort of controlled cycle. And I don't know if anybody has really got, like, you know, from a scientific point of view, if they could tell you exactly what's happening, but there's some gases that come off as the plant maybe kind of, you know, finishes its dying process, chlorophylls that are converting to sugars. And if you do it right, you get a much sweeter, smoother, more aromatic smoke. And if you do it wrong, you end up with something that smells and tastes a lot more like grass, you know, trimmed and laid off from the lawn.
Once it's cured, is there like an expiration date on it, or does it, how long does it stay good? What's the shelf life?
Yeah, it's certainly like, you know, it's not quite fresh fruit, you know, it's not like you're not measuring it in days. But I think there is a peak period. I mean, technically in California, anything that's 1 year past the testing date is expired and can't be sold. I think cannabis is probably more, you know, in the kind of 30 days to 60 day window is probably, you know, the ideal best buy date on it. But it really depends a lot on how it's stored. I mean, if you store something in a nitrogen flushed environment that's cool and the right humidity, it'll last a lot longer than if it's, you know, sitting in your car or a warehouse that is hot and cold and hot and cold and overly dry. I think probably the dryness is what kills it the most. If you drop the water activity too low, a lot of the terps, volatilize off. And once you lose those, then the quality's out the window.
Fascinating. I like the drying process being kind of like the barrel of the wine, like the steel or the oak or the,
Yeah, cool. I do think, you know, I think it's one of the things that if you see like some of the larger scale operations, a lot of times those are operated by people who are good growers and they think they can grow anything and they can grow stuff. They, you know, they can make a plant happy. But again, that's, you know, you saw it in Canada, right? All the way from, I think it was Canopy, who they planted 40 acres and didn't realize that 8 weeks later, they were going to need like 500 people to harvest it, right? Because they're thinking tomatoes or other veggies or whatever. And so the product, you know, never makes it even out of the greenhouse. To the next step, which is, you know, a lot of people are still just doing everything with wet trim and rack drying and things like that. And I think there are ways that that can be optimized, but that's not your highest quality product. It is much more like making wine than it is like growing vegetables.
Cool.
How did you learn about... Sorry, we all have so many questions. I know. We're so excited.
I know. You go. Mine was a silly question.
How did you learn how to grow, right? So you started in your dorm room. So how did you learn? Because I had buddies try to learn and like we just had really cool plants that didn't do anything.
I mean, it's a lot harder than... kind of, you know, it's weed, right? Of course it grows easy. All you do is throw it in there. And it's, you know, maybe it's like golf a little bit, right? Where like anybody can hit a golf ball, but you don't win just whacking a ball. You win with quality and consistency, right? And even, you know, sometimes people do it and you get lucky, right? But you also don't win a golf game with a hole in one. You win a golf game with consistently being two strokes under par. And I think, you know, cannabis, particularly on a professional level, is that, you know, we always say quality, consistency, and cost, right? So first you got to do it great, then you got to do it great every time. And then you have to do it great every time efficiently. And that's really as, you know, kind of as a brand and a business, what we're all about. In terms of how I actually learned how, I guess it's probably by collectively learning a lot of the things not to do. Right.
Yep. It's just like trading.
A lot of parallels there.
I feel like I've made most of the mistakes at least once. Luckily, I started doing that 25 years ago. So you can recognize some of the trends in that. But then, you know, the other thing is, you know, especially in the smaller days, right, I was just in there and I was kind of working hard through it. And not oftentimes smart. As you get bigger in scale, you have to work hard and smart, and then you have to build a team, right? So today at Glasshouse, I am not the best grower. I'm not really the best at anything. We've got an amazing team of, you know, labor experts and greenhouse experts and cannabis experts and processing experts. And I mean, just about every, you know, kind of specialty you can think of, we have somebody who is really good at it. And really, you know, what we produce and achieve is the collection of all that team working together. You know, even a football team of, you know, everybody can't be a quarterback or a center or a blocker, right? You need everybody doing their piece as part of a synchronized whole to really be successful.
So what channels do you use to disperse the weed now? Is it like a direct to consumer, or what do you do?
Yeah. So, we kind of, I would say Glasshouse has three main verticals. We have retail where we have four stores today. The pharmacy is the main brand. We also have one called The Pottery down in LA. That's Santa Barbara, Berkeley, Santa Ana, and Los Angeles. We have three more stores, that are under construction right now. One in UCSB or Isla Vista, which is a college town for the University of California, Santa Barbara. And then one up in San Ynez, which is the wine country of Santa Barbara, and then another in Eureka, which is up Northern California. So that's one section. The other section is our brands or CPG. Glasshouse Farms is the biggest one. That's, depending on the month, the number one or number two flower brand in the flower category, which is the biggest category in California, which is the world's largest market. Then we have Field, which is a connoisseur extract brand. So that's, you take buds, instead of harvesting them and drying them, you actually freeze them. So you freeze them fresh off the plant, and then you extract them either using hydrocarbons for live resin or solventless, which is basically just cold water for live rosin. So that's kind of a connoisseur extract brand, extracts and vapes. Mama Sue, which is a health and wellness brand that we did with a cannabis activist named Sue Taylor. That's like sleep and pain relief. Those are tinctures that are extracted. And then Forbidden Flowers, which is a flower brand that we do with Bella Thorne, who's an actress. So that's the one second vertical. And then the last one is wholesale. So we do a lot of white label supply where we grow for other brands or sell to other distributors. And then those distributors distribute it. And here you're thinking like, you know, pound bags of cannabis that are going off to be in other brands and things like that. In California, distribution is mandated, which means that all of our CPG, before it can go to the market, has to go to a distributor. We work with Herbal. Herbal's the largest distributor in the state. And so we give packaged product to them. They get the testing done, which again has to be like third party separate testing. And then that clears it in the market. And then they distribute to the, you know, 1,000 stores or so that are in California today.
Fascinating. What are they testing for?
State mandated stuff. So potencies, cannabinoids, THC, CBD, the other cannabinoids as the part the consumer pays the most attention to. We also test for terpenes because we think that's an important metric. And then the state is really looking for the compliance stuff, which is 66 different pesticides down to a parts per billion level, incredibly strict. They're looking for microbials like Aspergillus or E. coli, things like that. And they're looking for mycotoxins. And they're looking for heavy metals. So if you fail any of those tests, the product has to be destroyed.
How nice for the consumer.
Yeah, that seems intense for a consumer.
Yeah.
No, but how nice, right? Yeah. Like what, yeah. Just the, it's like FDA approval or what, like a,
yep.
Yeah, how nice. Yeah.
It makes me feel comfortable. Like yes. Instead of buying from the guy in a corner who could be, you know, who knows what he has. Could be drywall for all I know. Yeah. And almost gives you that, now,
if it looks like that, drywall, it might be a different product.
That is correct.
It is one of the upsides of the regulated market, right? I mean, there's a lot of friction, the taxes, the regulation, all that. One of the upsides is for sure the testing. I think knowing, I mean, I actually wish we could take potency off of it, because I think people chasing THC percentage is the equivalent of saying, what's your favorite wine? And someone saying, oh, the strongest one. Like, it just, it's not the important metric. But the pesticides and knowing that those aren't on the product, I mean, I know for a fact, you can see it in the illegal grows that get busted. Like, they're using things that shouldn't be used, period. And they're especially using things that shouldn't be combusted and inhaled, right? I mean, some things that are not a big deal if you eat them on your strawberries, when you light them on fire, they turn into things like hydrogen cyanide gas and stuff like that, right? So, like, that's awesome. The other thing that is also a great is, particularly on edibles, to know the potency that's in the package and know that it's that every time, because I think a lot of people get ruined with edibles when, you know, someone can eat brownie and you eat the brownie and they say, oh shit, you're only supposed to eat the corner, right? Like, you don't know, is it 100 milligrams or is it 10 milligrams? And when you have testing on the labels, if it's a 10 milligram piece, it's a 10 milligram piece every time. So if you want two, great. If you want half, great. But you can do that every single time, which I think is also key. If, you know, if a beer was 10X as strong one time as the last time, it'd make it really hard to have an enjoyable experience.
I mean, if you haven't had a bad edible experience, have you even lived? Part of growing up, I think.
But it scares people off, right? I mean, I'm super sensitive to edibles. 10 milligrams, way overload for me, right? I'm like a 2.5 milligram guy. So I kind of thought I didn't like edibles because I had a really hard time in the old days of not overdoing it. Now that I know that, like, you know, 1 to 2 milligrams is the right, you know, thing for me. We like Plus Gummies is a brand I should have mentioned. We're just about to close the acquisition of that. It's the number 4 edibles brand in the state of California. They make great gummies. And one of the things I like about them is that each of the little cubes is 1 milligram in most cases of THC, right? So I know 1 milligram and I'm good. If it's a Friday night or whatever, or going to a concert, then 2 or 3 of them instead. But it's always the same thing. And I realize, like, I actually like edibles. I just like a low dose of them and not having to worry that, like, I'm going to end up standing in the corner staring at the wall, not wanting to talk to anybody.
That's terrifying.
Yeah, no. Overdosing on mushrooms is a lot more enjoyable than overdosing on cannabis, in my experience.
Yep.
Way more anxiety.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
I have a business question for you. You mentioned acquisitions. I'm curious, like, are you buying, like, mom and pop shops and, like, distributing through them, or are you strictly just building your own kind of retail stores and your own brand?
Yeah, so, I mean, really all the above. Glasshouse Farms, for example, is a brand that we built. I started that back, 7 years ago. That was kind of, this is the logo here, which I modeled off of the old school, like the lemon logos out of the farms and stuff like that is kind of the inspiration for it. So we built that. Field, we acquired a couple of years ago. Mama Sue, we built in partnership with Sue Taylor. Forbidden Flowers, we built with Bella Thorne. Plus Gummies, when we close on it shortly here, will be an acquisition. On the retail side, we've opened some stores up fresh. You know, won the licenses de novo. We've acquired some stores, and you'll see more M&A from us on both fronts. But, you know, really our goal is to make cannabis brands and products that consumers love. That's what we're trying to do at the most fundamental level. And with our farms, we have large scale, high quality, efficient cultivation so that we can, we want to bring to the highest quality at the most affordable price to the market. And we find that we have a really good synergy when we sell our products through our stores, not because we, give someone a quota or like fire them, but if they don't sell it, but just they know the store, they've been to the farm, they visited it, they know how we treat people, they've met the growers, they know we, don't really use pesticides, they know that we support the community. And so when people come in and say, what do you recommend? They recommend, the products that we make because they know a lot about them. And so blending those things together, especially in the California market, is a really good synergy. But the tip of the spear is making those brands and products that resonate with consumers.
You should make a brand for moms.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, I think, in line with that, the market's not ready yet, but I'm a big believer in what they call type 2 genetics, which is lower potency genetics that have ratios of cannabinoids. So you know, most of what happens out there is everyone's just on this quest for the highest, not most number of milligrams of THC for the lowest dollars, right? Mm-hmm. But again, like wine, you don't pick your favorite wine or beer based on the potency, you pick based on flavor, smell, with how the brand makes you feel, what the price point is. So I think, you know, there's a lot of moms out there who would appreciate and prefer, right? I mean, I would say I'm in the same camp that if the cannabis tastes great, I would rather have it be less potent than more potent because I enjoy consuming it, right? And so just like I don't want a beer to be as strong as Everclear, a lower potency, good tasting type 2 genetic that has 10% THC and 8% CBD and tastes like strawberries, would I think, you know, there's a whole market of moms and others that would love that. And so I'd really like to see the market move to that kind of approach more.
Yeah, I talk about on the podcast all the time. So if you're a regular listener, you already know. If you're new, you don't know. But I have, over the past year, stopped drinking. Just health reasons and a lot of personal, just that something that I needed to do.
We call it California
do.
Sober out here. Yeah.
Yes. And there's certainly like a lot of my friends, I'm almost 40. I have kids. The pandemic was tough. Like there is sort of a nationwide, like women my age cutting back drinking. So there's like, there is an opportunity for that. And it would be so cool to have it branded like after the kids go to sleep or like get home from work or what, you know. I just feel like that there's a lot of people probably my age who would be like, oh, I would never do that, who now, like, as it's becoming more and more apparent how dangerous alcohol is, and
it's poison at the end of the day. No, I mean, I do it. I usually kind of do one sober month. And this time I added on a California sober month as well. And it's sober, at least for me, is hardish, right? You're just kind of out of the flow of what people are doing. California sober is actually very, very easy. I mean, I could do that in an indefinite amount of time. And you feel so much better. Like, you know, when I work out, I'm not struggling through feeling a headache, I sleep better. I mean, I track all my little biometrics with this ring thing, and it's not just how I feel, like it's tangibly, objectively, measurably lower resting heart rates, higher HRVs, better sleep quality. Like you can just see it. And then you get in a cycle when you're hungover, you eat poorly, and then you're tired, and then you're drinking more. And it's like you break out of that, and cannabis makes the world a better place. It's hard to say the same for alcohol.
Yep. It is hard to say the same, and it's hard. I don't know, the long-term effects of drinking heavily versus smoking, or like, it just seems like a bad decision was made when
maybe it should be the alcohol that has the child resistant packaging on it instead of the cannabis.
Yeah. But it's so socially normal. And a lot of that, I have two young kids, and a lot of stopping drinking was like, I don't really want them to grow up seeing
normalized.
Yeah. Like, oh, well, mom was having wine all the time or whatever. Like that. I don't know. I don't think that it's right.
No, I mean, I there's a lot from any rational, purely rational point of view. I think, you know, alcohol is poison. And it's fun poison sometimes, but it's poison at the end of the day. And it is interesting. Like when I do my sober thing, like you can feel you make people, you give them anxiety. I don't know exactly why, but like they have a hard time. It's not just like, oh, okay, you know, whatever, you don't like cilantro. It's like, why aren't you drinking? What's going on? Like, you know, I don't know if it makes them question why they're drinking or what, but it is interesting to see, you know, how socially normalized it is. And yet we treat cannabis, you know, with the massive taxes and all the regulations. And, you know, I mentioned the child resistant packaging in our dispensaries. We have two security guards, a man trap to get in there. We're scanning IDs. We're enforcing purchase limits. We have bulletproof glass. Products inside have tamper evident seals on them and child resistant packaging. And then the liquor store next door has one guy in the back, alcohol everywhere, no child resistant packaging. If a kid drinks the fifth of vodka, they die.
If
they eat the eighth of weed, they don't even get stoned, right? Maybe they get a stomach ache, but like nothing happens. And yet you know, we have this total mismatch of the fear that we bring to one and the normalcy that we have for the other.
Totally. Totally. I also, to your point, it is so interesting. I found over the last, I don't know, however many months, going and being with my friends, if you tell someone that you're sober or you're not drinking, they want to tell you about their relationship with alcohol. Mm-hmm. Like that, I like constantly get that. And it's just so fascinating. Like, I don't care what you're really like. This is, I can't drink. And that's a personal thing. But then it also puts like some friction on some relationships. It's all weird and sort of a strange thing. And like, how did we get here?
Yeah. It is. I mean, I guess we got here with 50 years of a drug war, right? Where, I mean, you know, I remember when I first told my daughter, this was before I was truly in cannabis. I was just in ancillary business making fertilizers and things like that for it. And she was nine or something like that. So it's at fourth grade or something in that area. And, you know, she came home and started crying because I was doing something cannabis related because her teacher had just finished telling her good people don't use cannabis. You're a drug dealer, right? My dad's a drug dealer. She went around and cried for a while. And we had to have a lot of conversations. And then I think even, you know, for a couple of years after that, if people had asked her what I did, she'd tell them I had a boring 9-to-5 job. That was her answer. She didn't want to talk about it, right? And so that's why, you know, 50 years of that has a lot of people thinking good people don't use cannabis. And, you know, the doctors and the CEOs and the attorneys and the things like that, successful people out there, for the most part, still are very bashful about their cannabis use. It's getting better. But, you know, the old days, they lied about it, yet they'd all happily stand there in the middle of a party drinking a cocktail. And so society assumes that, you know, if the only guy smoking cannabis is the guy who's panhandling in front of 7-Eleven and all the successful people are denying they do it, then society starts to assume that things are correlated when they're really not.
I think it's changed though.
Yeah.
It's getting better. A lot of my friends, like, I start to notice as I get older, they don't really drink anymore. Things like that. I talk about the podcast all the time. Like, I'm a very light drinker. Like, I'll drink like a beer or two. And like, to me, like, oh, like, you know, you have a problem, something like that. I'm like, no, I just don't like drinking. I don't smoke weed either. Like, it's not my thing.
Yeah.
I don't care if anyone does or they want to. It's just not for me. And I think just kind of the whole relationship that Americans have with drugs is just like off. Not drugs, but just like substances in general. Like, hey man, I always come from the boat. Like, if you want to do what you want to do, do it. But yeah. I don't know. I think media and everything kind of jams it down people's throat. And Penny, your idea for the mom brand, I thought of my mom too, because she hasn't drank in 30 years. And I think like a nice low dose, just get a little buzzed up, probably help, you know, if moms out there that smoke and stuff like that, smoke a little before they go to bed and wake up fine. But totally. They're all taking Xanax.
Like, totally. And people older than me who are moms too, I think that it would be a nice thing. And if it was a mom brand, then you'd be like, well, it's for moms. I'm going to use it. It's for moms.
Yeah. Mom's little helper.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yo, that was good.
Yeah. I have told the story on here before, but I pulled I have a slip disc in my back and I was about to go skiing and could not walk and call my mom and was like, I don't know what to do. Like, I'm out of muscle relaxers. I can't take enough Advil. I was really in a bad place. And she was like, you got to go to the store and get the CBD. And I was like, mom, like, this is my mom telling me that, like, I got to go get the CBD. Went straight to the store, got the CBD, walked, skied the next day. Like, immediately I was totally fine.
And this is Schedule 1, no known medical benefit, high potential for abuse.
Right.
While we have cigarettes and alcohols pushed in media and commercials and et cetera. It's kind of crazy.
I now have so much CBD for all the aches and pains of life. Like, just bathe myself in it.
Crazy. But, you know, the good news is, you know, we are making progress, right? I mean, even the Senate's passing bills that allow for research. Canada's legalized, so now the medical schools and the, you know, scientists can get into it. You know, Mexico seems not too far behind. Germany is starting to do things. So, you know, again, the truth always happens, as my friend Jason Wild says. And I think, you know, the truth about this comes out because it, there's too many stories like yours. And it's like, you know, what's the downside again? Like, the only downside to cannabis is the drug war that tears families apart and puts people in prison. Other than that, it's like, you know, it's there's a lot more up than down from what I can see.
Totally.
Question about the prison thing. What about those programs that are giving back to people who got arrested for marijuana charges and now they're able to open a business? Do you have any experience working with those individuals?
So, colleagues? Social equity is kind of the heading that goes under. Okay. And I think, you know, some states, one thing I will say about the industry itself, I think deserves a lot of credit for its intention and maybe not so much credit for it's actually happened.
Okay.
So, you know, I do think it's, if you look at cannabis relative to, you know, I don't know, like car manufacturing or whatever, right? Like there's a whole lot of intention for an industry that's small and nascent, social justice, social equity and the environment, right? Like there's a lot of thoughts around it. If you look at what's actually been achieved so far on those two, it's social justice, getting people out of prison, social equity, which is getting, you know, the progress in the industry, the successes are few and far between. Each state typically has its own social equity program and they do it different ways.
Okay.
And then like in California, for example, it's even down to the municipality, right? So LA City, somewhere in LA, I forget if it's county or city, has a social equity program. The rollout of that has been kind of a disaster, right? And a lot of times the intentions are good, but the structure is not great, which is, you can't, giving somebody the opportunity if they don't have the funding, the training, the skills to capitalize on it isn't really giving them much, right? And so you need to find some way that it doesn't just become a predatory thing where, you know, someone loans them the money but sets up terms or kind of waiting for them to fail, they take the thing back. And it's like, you know, it really is a hard, it's important and it's in good intentions, but structuring it in a way that's successful for everybody is really challenging. I personally like what New York is doing right now in their setup, where they're going to set up a significant chunk of money to help fund some of the social equity, you know, people who have been arrested or have immediate family who have been arrested. They're going to prioritize them and then they're going to help them be successful, at least with funding. I don't know, you know, far be it from me to design a program, but I think ideally you'd be looking for ways to actually help and train. You know, it's like, if you put me in a Formula One race car, I wouldn't win the race, right? Well, first you got to give me driver's lessons and then you got to give me the car and then you got to give me the opportunity and the gas, right? And so blending all those together to make it successful is the real challenge.
Cool. But companies like you can almost do your own thing, right? Like if you see a guy who has like a small charge, you can bring him in as like maybe a low level entry role and let him work his way up.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So and I'm curious if there's like a initiative among like the community itself to also bring those people up with them.
Yeah. So, you know, one thing is, as long as the regulations allow it, we don't discriminate
against
anybody that has, you know, previous drug charges. I mean, the biggest, you know, cannabis felon out there, I guess, at this point, or somewhere, you know, right? Like, so, you know, nonviolent drug offenses are not something that we screen against for hiring. We're actually doing a bunch of work with Weldon Angelos and Mission Green on the social justice side. There's still, I think, 2,700 people in prison for nonviolent cannabis offenses. There's another, you know, 20,000 in jails for it. They're still putting people in jail for it. They just sentenced you know, a guy for $900 of cannabis to, you know, 8 years or something like that, right? I mean, $900 of cannabis is, you know, what we sell per every 20 minutes or whatever the math is.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, here we are paying taxes, creating 500 jobs, supporting the community, feeding families, et cetera, and they're going to, you know, prison, right, for a decade. So, you know, there's a massive inequity there. Weldon and Mission Green are doing a lot on that, trying to get clemency and getting people out of prison. And, you know, I think I would put aside all the business stuff if we can make that piece go faster, right? It's hard to talk about business things when 3,000 people, you know, are sitting in prison for doing what we do day in and day out.
Absolutely. No, you put it in a good way. And I think being a smaller industry and starting to come up, you guys can kind of set your own standards and you can lead the pack. I know, you know, and the government doesn't necessarily do the best job. Sometimes they have good intentions, but you can't always, you know, trust them. But no, I respect that. That was a good answer.
Yeah, thank you.
For those of you who are, you know, Penny Lane Pod fans, you should go back and listen to the Real Simple Ariel episode. He's one of the best traders I personally know, just a monster trader. And he was in jail for weed for 18 months and got out of jail, learned how to trade, and is an absolute success story. But it's a good
monster.
Episode.
Monster.
Oh, like someone like Parker Coleman, who's in jail for basically a, you know, quasi-life sentence. He's in jail. He could buy stock in our company for doing what he's in prison for, right? I mean, it's like, how does that make sense, right? Of course, it's not wrong.
Something's broken.
Yeah, it's not wrong. What we're doing is not wrong. It's wrong that he's in prison for it. And so, like, you know, we need to fix that. Is, you know, it's far past when it should have been fixed.
So speaking of buying stock in your company, how did you decide to transfer it, or how did you decide to make it a publicly traded company? And what are the benefits of doing that?
Yeah. So, so we went public about 9 months ago now via a SPAC with Mercer Park. We did it on the NEO exchange up in Canada. You know, of course, again, the silliness of cannabis is Canadian cannabis companies can be public in the US, but US cannabis companies have to be, can only be public in Canada. And the NEO exchange is the one that allows SPACs. The way a SPAC works, for people who don't know, is it's, I kind of call it a, you know, a pre-funded IPO. It's a way to go public, but the money's actually there before you go public versus afterwards. And the reason we did it, was because there's a unicorn of a greenhouse that we wanted to acquire. It's our new greenhouse down in Camarillo, Ventura County, second largest greenhouse in the United States. Eventually, you know, I think it becomes the largest cannabis greenhouse in the world. We're doing it in stages, so we're not bringing all of that online now. We're actually just, you know, bringing on 600,000 square feet of canopy or so. But that was a $120 million greenhouse plus another $100 million in equity. We got the purchase price negotiated down to $93 million plus $100 million in equity. But really the only way, and then it needs, you know, some retrofit work, the only way that you can raise that kind of money is by going public, right? There's not the raising 150 million bucks other ways is pretty tough to do. The SPAC in particular is good for raising larger amounts. So we went public to buy the greenhouse, and the reason to go, you know, the only way to buy the greenhouse was going public, if that makes sense. If it hadn't been for that greenhouse, I'm not sure we would have, because we just wouldn't have had a good fiduciary use for that money other than this big, you know, project. So for us, it made sense to do. Being public is interesting. There's, you know, there's upsides and downsides. There's a lot of regulatory compliance. There's a lot of overhead, quarterly reports, disclosures, you know, full audits. We're all GAAP, you know, lots of costs of legal and attorneys. The upsides, though, is you also now, in addition to having a, you know, cash currency, you've got an equity currency. So, for example, Plus, we bought for about $25 million. It's all equity, right? And so we can acquire a company that, again, you know, $25 million, especially these days in cannabis, is a big number if you're paying in cash. We can print shares. And so as long as it's not dilutive and we feel it's accretive to our shareholders, of which, you know, I'm a big one and haven't taken any money off the table. And so, you know, every morning I put my feet on the ground as a shareholder first. As long as it makes sense to do that deal, we can make it happen without writing a check. And that's something you can only do as a pubco.
Very cool. Very cool. So exciting.
Yeah, it is.
Right? To go from your closet to where you are now. What a
You ever think you were going to, this was ever going to happen? Like, do you think it was fate, or what kind of clicked in your head where it was like, you know, this is what I want to do?
I certainly can't say, you know, I was not sitting there in college having the grand plan of, you know, going public and buying the, you know, second, you know, the biggest cannabis greenhouse in history. That I would be lying to say that it knocked out like that. But, you know, I really do believe in the power of cannabis. I think it does make the world a better place, or I wouldn't be doing what I was doing. I think it's a generational, once in a lifetime, you know, kind of like the internet or the iPhone or,
absolutely,
you know, things like that, or into prohibition, right? Like it, this opportunity to go from zero to one, in terms of legal cannabis market is an amazing opportunity. And so, you know, for me to do something that I think makes the world a better place, you know, build a great company for our employees, make products that consumers love, and create, you know, hopefully tons of value for our shareholders. Like, usually you just get to pick a couple of those things, right? And to be able to do all those things at once is kind of a dream come true. So I guess, you know, somewhere between my entrepreneurship, not being scared of things that people have never done before, my tech and science background, and loving cannabis is the, I'm just the right place at the right time.
Paul on YouTube, I owe you an apology because the mom brand cannabis could also be a stay-at-home dad or any kind of dad. I'm sorry I wasn't being inclusive there.
Cannabis doesn't assume gender.
Yeah. That's awesome. You seem very mission, like, driven almost. Like, I don't know. You seem like you wake up every morning and you have, like, a purpose.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there is a certain, you know, I think we have an opportunity to do something in a way that, you know, no one's ever done it before. I think that, you know, just like you find books about the end of prohibition, I think they'll write books about the end of the war on drugs. And, you know, I hope we've got a nice positive chapter or two in there. And, you know, I hope we make a bunch of people a bunch of money, and I hope we make a bunch of consumers happy, and, you know, create a company that has long enduring value for all the people who work here. So I do think we're
hell yeah.
Good work.
That is my same reason for starting the podcast. I thought it was like really a pivotal moment for retail traders. And I was like, when they write the book about this, I want to have had a voice.
Yep.
In the whole thing.
No, I hope everybody lives a little bit like that, right? It's like, you know, what marker, you know, going out and making a dent in the world a little bit, right? I think Steve Jobs had a good quote, I'll paraphrase, which is, you know, to not forget that the universe was invented by people no smarter than us, right? It's not like there is not some anointed person who gets to make it up. Like, we all get to make it up. So go out there and make a dent and be as positive about what you do as you can.
Totally. So I know you ask me, or no, I ask you, and then I completely forgot what you said. Are you in the music business or you're a music fan?
Yeah, no, I'm not in the music business. I was kind of in the music business. I was one of the original folks at Sonos, which is a home audio system. I was part of the original team over there. So from that point of view, we were making and inventing things that people enjoy with music. But other than playing the trumpet for a year in fourth grade.
Yo, I played the trumpet too.
The chagrin of everyone around me. I'm not in the music business. I was on the board of directors for the Santa Barbara Bowl, which is a 5,000 person outdoor venue in Santa Barbara, which is my hometown, for 17 years. And, you know, we just had our first show, the concert of the season, on Saturday, Portugal the Man and Alt J. So I try and see a good 30 or 40 or 50 concerts a year. But other than that, I'm just a consumer.
Cool. That's a good venue.
Yeah. You know, it's amazing. I think it's that and Red Rocks are probably two of the best in the country. I'm partial to the Santa Barbara Bowl just because the size is so intimate. I mean, the Hollywood Bowl is great, but the entire Santa Barbara Bowl fits inside the box seats of the Hollywood Bowl. So it's like, you know, when you're in the fifth row at the Santa Barbara Bowl, you're 20 feet away from the performers, and that's pretty special.
Red Rocks, living in Boulder, you must have quite the tie.
Yeah, Red Rocks is another good spot. Again, you know, beautiful place, outdoor, but, you know, much larger than the Bowl. So, you know, that intimacy of the Santa Barbara Bowl is hard to beat.
Also, hiking up to the top of Red Rocks, depending on how you're feeling, is really
tired.
In the drain, especially if you've flown in that day. Woo! Altitude will get you.
And a few drinks and everything else before you go to a concert, you know?
Yeah. Red Rocks is, you can't breathe there. It's so much climbing.
Yeah. It is a good spot, but it is a bit of work. Yeah, and a mile high, like you said.
So. Yeah.
Out of breath. Now, I have some more business questions for you we touched on before the pre-show.
Sure.
So I'm very familiar with the banking industry, and I'm curious how you navigate I want to call it kind of a shit storm when it comes to cannabis and banking. You know, put it, yeah, because I know there's some legal things you can't do. And you said you actually were able to secure loans, everything like that. So I'm curious, like, how you went about that, how your brand and your company is navigating that shithole. I'm just going to call it a shithole because it's not fair to you.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I think a couple of things. One is we're one of the lucky ones. And I think it's important to distinguish between unbanked and underbanked.
Okay.
Right. Cannabis, you know, is, and so for some people is unbanked and for some people is underbanked. Right. And
okay.
So we're one of the lucky ones to have bank accounts and, you know, those types of things, but we're still vastly underbanked.
Like yeah.
Lines of credits and stuff like that.
It's ridiculous.
Are almost unheard of in cannabis. And it's part of the reason that I'm a big advocate and think that our, you know, the U.S. Congress and Senate need to get their shit together and pass safe banking is it's good public policy because it keeps people safer because they don't have cash on site.
Yep.
And it's also social equity as well, because, again, we're a larger company, audited, public, you know, 70 millions in growing in revenue, et cetera, right? Like, we can get bank accounts. Somebody who needs help, who's starting a first business, who's been harmed by the war on drugs, who's trying to open, you know, a brand or store, like they can't. And that makes what is hard harder. And so I think safe banking is good for the safety of people. You know, you don't have to look very hard to see people getting shot at dispensaries because they're easy targets. It's good public policy because it keeps cash in bank accounts, which means taxes get paid and workers' comp and all the other things that come with the tracking. It's good for the industry because we can use credit cards, which I think would grow, you know, the industry by a good, you know, 25 to 30%. And then it's good social equity because the people who have the hardest time now and need the help the most would find some relief. So I think that's something that, you know, really should happen. We did it by starting 3 years ago, building relationships with on prior relationships and, you know, being one of the first cultivation customers of a large bank that wanted to get into space. And, you know, they did site visits and they did audits and they did inspections of our offices and records. And, you know, really what they're trying to prove is that they're not going to become complicit in some nefarious operation. And so that takes a lot of work for them. And then they need to get compensated for it to make sense for their business. That relationship eventually grew into the $100 million loan that we just recently pulled down. And so, you know, now they're getting paid for it, which they get outsized returns because it's cannabis. So
yep. You have to pay higher rates, don't you?
Yeah. So, I mean, we got a good deal at 10%, which is
probably unheard of. Yeah.
What you would pay in any other industry.
That's probably pretty good for your industry though. Cause consider, you know, the risk of the business, yeah. I'm sure they probably charge 15, 20 and just absolutely just destroy people.
Yeah. I mean, I think the best I've seen is 8%, and that was, I forget, Curaleaf or Trulieve, which is, you know, one of the biggest companies out there. So at 10%, we're doing pretty well.
Awesome.
Cool. So where do you see your business in 5 years? Like what new, that question stands for itself. I don't need to over-explain.
Yeah. I mean, so cannabis is, I think, really is challenging to forecast, right? I sometimes say, every day is Monday and every week's a year. So, you know, 5 years in cannabis might be 50 years in another industry. But, you know, I think what I would like to see us do is become a brand, you know, kind of house, right? So an analogy might be like a Diageo or an AB InBev or, you know, something like that, where we're a platform where we're helping, you know, brands maybe that were legacy brands that want to persevere, where we're building brands, where we're acquiring brands. You know, I think I would like to see us with a top three brand in every category and maybe a couple, you know, a handful of top 20 brands in each category, different price points, different quality, you know, price intersections, edibles, flower, vapes, you know, et cetera. I think, you know, we have the scale or the potential scale for, you know, national and even global distribution. Our new farm, we're turning on, you know, the first phase of it, which is about a third of it, but there's a whole bunch of idle capacity that stays in vegetables that we can turn to cannabis kind of whenever we want. I think legalization happens, and I think interstate commerce happens. And I think that consumers want cannabis, and just like champagne comes from France and tequila comes from Mexico, I think for most people, cannabis comes from California. So for us to build that platform and stable of brands and products, first here in California, which is, I think, the best proving ground anywhere on the planet, and then eventually selling those products across the country and across the planet. And, you know, again, hopefully making people feel better with plants.
Really cool.
You can't sell to other states, right?
No, okay. No, not. I mean, if you want to get into details, I think that a ban on interstate commerce is unconstitutional. But until somebody's ready to test the dormant commerce clause and prove that, we are California only.
Okay.
California actually just introduced legislation to allow the import and export at the state level. Oregon has it already baked into their regulations, but there's this kind of, I think it's more of a theory than evidence that the federal government somehow doesn't mind interstate commerce, but would be opposed to interstate commerce. I'm not sure that's actually the case, but nobody really wants to go first to test.
Yeah, no one wants to go, hey, me first, because then it opens up a whole door of shenanigans.
Yep. Someone on YouTube was wondering about, he lives in New York, and I'm not totally understanding the question, but he's wanting to know what your brand is like, what your brand reputation would be in New York, and sort of like how easy would it be once you could sell to New York to then get into that market?
I mean, New York's super exciting. They're going absolutely gangbusters over there. They're doing it ahead of the regulations right now. There's a dispensary on every corner. There's people in Washington Square Park selling pounds of weed next to girls selling Girl Scout cookies. So it may be one notch beyond where it truly should be. But obviously, people are very excited. New York's a huge market. I think we'd do great there, right? I mean, I think if you think of us as like the Casamigos of cannabis for the Whole Foods consumer, like, that's a lot of New York, right? You think California cannabis goes right to the top of the stack in New York. What we're trying to do is basically sun grown indoor, right? So it's environmentally friendly because we use the sun, but we have a good climate control that allows us to grow very close to indoor quality. So if you think about New York, enjoys a premium product that's, you feel good about, that comes from California like cannabis should, that's grown in the climate it should. And, you know, it's going to be half the cost of indoor. I think Glass House in New York or peanut butter and chocolate.
Love that. I love that whole analogy. We were in New York a couple of weeks ago, and there are dispensaries.
Yeah, everywhere. It's crazy. I mean, it's like they're I was there and I went to a couple of them. And it's like they're doing all kinds of stuff you couldn't actually do in a dispensary in California. Like you're not supposed to be able to see product from the sidewalk outside the store. And like in New York, you can walk down the street. And like, I mean, Washington Square Park, I got a picture of a guy, you know, he wasn't just selling eights and edibles. Like, he had a couple pounds in his bag and he was just in the middle of the park slinging away.
That's a city.
Yeah, we walked by one, and it was like a street party. There was like a DJ, and like, it was a whole thing. We went in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hung out.
And you know, a lot of California products on the shelf, out there as well. So just, you know, kind of proving the point that you're not following the rules. You could get it from anywhere, right? Florida's closer, Rhode Island's closer, Maine, Massachusetts, plenty of places where you don't have to drive across the country, but still what they want to put on the shelf is California cannabis products. And I think that people are telling you what they want before they can have it. Once they can have it, they're not going to change their mind.
What's your personal opinion on like actual weed versus like vaping or oil or like,
I mean, I personally like smoking joints. That's me. But I can understand, you know, all the categories. Right. And I think it's people who think they don't like cannabis just don't know how they like it yet. Right. And that may mean you don't like the psychoactive side, but a bath bomb for your arthritis is awesome. Or maybe it's, you're not trying to get stoned, but tinctures help you sleep better or help, you know, your slip disc. Or maybe you want to party and, you're taking 100 milligram edible because it's that or opiates. Right. And self-medicating, or you're smoking a joint, or you like concentrates because, you know, same people take shots instead of drinking Chardonnay, right? Like,
that's a good analogy.
The whole spectrum is available to people. And, you know, I think you just got to find the way that you like it and then titrate it and then enjoy it.
Cool. Wasn't there a controversy recently about vaping and there being like
vitamin E acetate? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Vape gate. So, I mean, again, upside to the regulated market, right? Is that people aren't putting random chemicals into products in there because they all have to be tested. So that was, you know, vitamin E acetate. I don't know exactly what it's used for normally, but one of the things we found was that it shouldn't be vaporized and inhaled. So, you know, I'm glad that, sorry that people got, I mean, obviously it had nothing to do with our products, but, you know, sorry that people got sick. Glad it came to the service. Glad it was identified on what it was. And now, you know, glad that people have the awareness that there are upsides to walking into a licensed dispensary and shopping there versus Washington Square Park.
Yep. I love it. I love the regulation.
Yeah. I mean, there's good sides, right? It's overly taxed and in some places overly regulated, but the pendulum swung from prohibition to overregulation. I think it'll come back, somewhere in the middle to appropriate regulation, right? Like we have for alcohol. You don't want people making bathtub gin and you don't want people selling it who don't check IDs for kids and stuff. On the other hand, you don't need, you know, to treat it like it's nuclear waste and it's going to steal your babies. And that's kind of where we're at.
Yeah, literally shoot like nuclear waste if you think about it. Your analogies are on point, especially when it comes to the concentrates and the shot. Like I'm going to use that literally tonight. That's really what it is.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. Like, I mean, you think of Canada, right? They had these level 9 vaults where people were spending millions of dollars on like hardened bunker vaults for a plant. Like, I mean, this is not gold. It wasn't Fort Knox, right? I mean, it's more valuable than broccoli, but it's probably not more valuable than 25-year aged whiskey. And yet, like, we don't even, you know, I don't even know if you have to control how that's stored, right?
It's behind the counter at the store, right?
Yeah, right. You know, with one guy, and yet, you know, nobody worries that out, you know, anyway, it's crazy.
16-year-old working the counter going, hey, you look all right. I'm like, all right.
Yeah. There you go.
Well, Graham, we're at the end of our time.
Sure.
You are incredibly refreshing.
Yes.
Oh, thank you very much.
I think it's very easy to tell how you're as successful as you are. This was really delightful. I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, my pleasure. Enjoy.
Yeah.
I even learned something.
All right.
I'm shocked. I thought I knew everything. And now you actually taught me a lot. I really, seriously, you're super well spoken and I can tell why you're successful. I have to second that one.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, cannabis is easy to talk about. We're incredibly lucky to be here. It's hard work and there's lots to work on, but you know, to be at this moment in time where we get to have a piece in making the world a better place is pretty damn awesome. So thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Thank you.
By accessing this podcast, you acknowledge that the Penny Lane podcast makes no warranty, guarantee, or representation as to the accuracy or sufficiency of the information featured in this podcast. The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this podcast are for general information only, and any reliance on the information provided in this podcast is done at your own risk. This podcast should not be considered professional or financial advice. Unless specifically stated otherwise, the Penny Lane podcast does not endorse, approve, recommend, or certify any information, product, process, service, or organization presented or mentioned in this podcast, and information from this podcast should not be referenced in any way to imply such approval or endorsement. The third-party materials or content of any third-party site referenced in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions, standards, or policies of the Penny Lane podcast. The Penny Lane podcast assumes no responsibility or liability for the accuracy or completeness of the content contained in third-party materials or on third-party sites referenced in this podcast, or the compliance with applicable laws of such materials and/or links referenced herein.